come to Muffin Talk. Hello and welcome to Muffin Talk. This program is brought to you by the initiative Titi Paunamu, Study and Joy. Today we have a special broadcast. This will be the last broadcast on the radio. But don't worry, Muffin Talk will continue to be available online. We will continue to invite a guest once a week for an interview. And while it was not an easy decision to cancel the radio program, but with most of my listeners tuning in online, I think it is time for them to have the choice to listen or to listen and watch if they like. So please continue to be tuned in on www.studyjoy.nz. So in today's Muffin Talk, I'm presenting to you a number of recordings of the last more than 10 years of the radio program. Here it goes.
Delighted to welcome Vietti to our family of Planet FM.
There are many different forms of meditation. The form that I was formed in when I was a student is very different from what I practice now. It was very much what we call mental prayer, thinking about God, thinking of a gospel passage, imagining oneself within that, and imagining what God would be saying to me. So very much a mental process, whereas this practice that I follow now is, we call it prayer of the heart, and the essential aspect of it is just letting go of all thoughts, and doing so by the praying of a mantra or prayer word. And the particular prayer word that we use, or that is recommended, it's not essential, is the word Maranatha, which is really the most ancient Christian prayer.
So what is the mantra in the Christian world?
The mantra, it's a prayer word, simply. And just the simple repetition of this word. And naturally, one prays, when one is still, distractions come flooding in. And as soon as one becomes aware that one is distracted, the teaching is to simply go back to just listening to this word. And gradually it leads to a greater stillness. And the recommendation is that one does this twice a day, early morning, and at the end of the working day, prior to eating. Yeah, it's no good meditating on a full stomach.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the difference? What is the main difference between Christian meditation and other sorts of meditation?
Well, people often identify meditation with Eastern practices, Buddhism, Hinduism, and they have a longer and an unbroken tradition of meditation than we have, certainly in the West. In Eastern Christianity, there is that unbroken tradition. Might not all practice it, but nevertheless, they know what it is. But in the West, we've lost touch with that. So it seems to reemerge, particularly at times, creative periods, times of breakdown. And that's very much why it appeals today to people, because they can find in this practice, come to their own center. And in coming to their center, they find themselves, there's that still point of peace, a sense where everything is one. In my own experience, that was very important to find that, because it became an anchor at a time when I needed an anchor, something to some stability.
And Matthew is named both apostle and evangelist. Does this make him even more special?
I don't think. I wouldn't put it that way. No. I'd say he's one of the unique characters, in a sense, of the first century, because he's writing from his own perspective, and that then makes him somewhat special, but I would think that he has a skill that compares with the skill of Luke, but they're really writing for different audiences. And therefore, you can see what's happening in the early church as each of these individuals works with people and then proclaims the message and sort of defines the message for them. They have a different style and a different set of stories, a different set of expressions and creedal statements that they're going to rely upon. So that would be my response, really.
So St. Matthew, who was he? Is this the same St. Matthew, the tax collector, who was eager to meet Jesus and invite him into his house? Was it the same person, the St. Matthew the evangelist?
This is the big question, of course, for biblical scholars. You know, the debates around Matthew have gone on for a number of years in the modern biblical critical world. So therefore, there is a sense whereby you'd say, well, perhaps if he's one of these Galilean personalities, that is from the north of the Holy Land, and he's a fisherman or a type like that, or comes from that sort of background, perhaps he wouldn't be quite as skilled as an author. And so you'd probably make a distinction about the apostle, strictly speaking, and then the evangelist. But I think in the tradition, we've added another title into the picture, and I would put three titles alongside his name: tax collector, apostle, and evangelist. And the way the church then remembers the person called Matthew is to play upon that threefold sense, if you like. And the idea is then that when we look back at the history books, as it were, we find very little information about a number of the early church members. And Matthew is a typical character from the early church that we know little of.
So you're the convener of this committee, and you're that is focusing on the protection of life, as you said, from its conception to natural death. Yet you're specialized on post-abortion counseling. This means counseling for women who have already had an abortion. Can you tell us more about your work as a counselor?
Well, very often, in fact, most times, the women who come are actually suicidal. And many of them would have spent years trying to figure out what's at the bottom of their heartache. But we have to understand that it's obviously we want to protect every single life. And that includes all of the human living people. And all of those women who have been wounded by abortions and their families, their extended families, their grandparents, their parents, the fathers, those people, they have a need to grieve. And society just doesn't allow them that space. And it's remarkable. I've seen women grieving a 5-week-old fetus just as if it was a 5-year-old child, you know. And they just need time. They need love and they need time. And they need to know that it's important, that their grief is important and their child was important. And it's about bringing them to reconciliation, to forgive all those people who have hurt them, to bring them right through that grief stages. There's a lot of anger often. And bring them through to forgiving them, those other people, often the doctors and the medical staff, and then finally forgiving themselves. Because if they don't forgive themselves, they go through life still damaged and hurting.
How important do you think is spirituality in a person's life?
Well, it is widely important, but today's the society is being missing this. I can't accuse the individual, any persons, because of the vast majority of the education system, media, and certain type of understanding, it's fluxing and pumping up the secular lifestyle more important than the some other important things. So any individual under these circumstances, it's difficult to understand spirituality. But the spirituality, sometimes you don't need to be measured. Just a couple of minutes of the dark room or dark sky, you can feel it. is screaming your inside. Today's society is big missing, and that's why the many young generations, they try to settle or stop it. They're screaming through the usage of the substance or doing some nonsense. That spirituality, it's really screaming inside every individual that says, feed me, understand me, and communicate to me. But we don't know the language or communication or connectedness of the spirituality of ourselves in a spectrum. We try to solve the problem outer world, and that to create the more problem. Like the people are thirsty, need to be drink the water to satisfy the thirstiness. We do more the drinking the salt water. I don't blame the society. The spiritual lifestyle is being screaming, defeat me, understand me, communicate me. Instead, we just ignore it and give it to more the materialistic type of lifestyle.
Kiribati is located right on the equator in the central Pacific. You can find Kiribati northwest of Hawaii. So when you go to the map, when you see the map, of course, you will see a dotted atoll highlands, 33 atoll highlands altogether.
33 islands?
Yeah, 33 atoll highlands altogether. And only 24, 25 of them are inhabited by people.
So 10 of these atoll islands are not inhabited.
That's very true, yeah. And we have a population of about over 100,000, 102,000 people altogether. In Kiribati, the weather is summer all year round. At 6 o'clock, at 6 o'clock in the morning, the sun rises. At 6 o'clock in the afternoon or in the evening, the sun sets.
Makes Kiribati really so vulnerable and its inhabitants, of course.
Yeah, you're very right. We are the very forefront of the climate change impact. Our atoll islands are only 1.5 meters above sea level.
1.5 meters?
Yeah, that's very true. And we are very vulnerable to water sea rise due to the effects of climate change that is eroding our foreshores. Many houses and crops, especially the food and water, have been damaged.
What do you grow in Kiribati?
Most commonly coconut trees, pantanus trees, breadfruits.
Breadfruits.
Yeah. We have some crops that kumara, yeah, and many others. But unfortunately, these crops or the food are being eroded by the water sea rise, affecting the many of the other islands, especially in the South Island. During the king died, that's when it is very severe, because the water comes on the land. People have to relocate where they live, and they have to move to the inwards. They have to live in the center of the land, because living near the beach is not safe, because the water sea rise is there.
Are there any hills? Or?
No, Kiribati is flat as an atoll island. All the atoll islands are flat. And as I said, it's only 1.5 meters above sea level.
So when a big wave comes?
Yeah, you can say that. When the big wave comes, yeah, that's it. Our future in Kiribati is not certain, because Kiribati will disappear from this planet due to rising sea level. And I always come back to that, due to the rising sea level. And the question is often asked by a lot of our people, who is responsible and how can we make the difference? I guess that the international community has a big responsibility to help combat the effect of climate change, and also to help smaller nations in the Pacific, especially Kiribati, that we are becoming victims now.
The word didike literally means the training. It's the Greek word for training. And we think of the early church as having things like the letters of Paul, and then later having documents like the Gospels. But quite apart from these The letters of Paul were occasional things. They were occasioned by particular needs. And the Gospels are the written down recordings of gospelers who were coming to give a performance, an overview of the whole vision of Christian faith. But the people in the communities, in the local churches scattered all across the Mediterranean world, they needed something that would be their training. And the training began as something very simple, and it kept developing. And when it was still in the simple stage in the first and second centuries, it was something that every disciple of Jesus actually learned off by heart. Now, we knew that this existed because we had lots of references. They had learned the training, and they had read the training, and they had copied the training. And we knew, everyone said, well, what was it like? And people said, well, it probably included the Lord's Prayer. Yeah, well, so much. You don't have to be brilliant to make that guess. It probably included something like some sort of variant on the Ten Commandments. Well, again, you wouldn't have to be very bright to make that guess. But then, in 1873, a brilliant young Greek monk was working in a library in Constantinople, now Istanbul, cataloguing books. And the funny thing about this particular librarian was he had already spent a couple of years in Germany, and indeed he had there met all of the great editors. So as he was going through the book, his mind was alerted to be looking out for unusual things, and he discovered a copy of the Didache, a copy of the Didache that reflects the way the Didache was used in Greek around 80 AD. And this is the most precious document we have from the Christians from the first century that's not in the New Testament. And it's even more precious because all of the documents in the New Testament were special documents. This is the ordinary document. This gives us an insight into what was actually happening in a local church at the time. And so, for instance, it's got a very detailed list of do's and don'ts. And then we thought, well, that's very unusual. And then we found in 1947, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, we thought, aha, now we have a copy in Aramaic of the same thing that we find in a Christian document in Greek. And we realized that an awful lot of the moral practice that the Christians were putting forward to these Greek converts to the religion of Jesus, wasn't yet called Christianity, in the middle of the first century, they're actually using a document that was being used for training little Jewish boys and girls back in Palestine, which we had also lost. Human beings are almost incurably religious. Even if they're not very obviously religious, or even if they say they're not religious, there is this somehow sense that there's something larger, there's mystery. And once you actually say there is mystery, you seek to address it. And it's that address that's prayer. Where Christian prayer comes in is that Jews and Christians and Muslims would say that they're is a dialogue between God and the individual, and between dialogue and the human family. And that dialogue takes the form of the invitation to pray. And so all three religions have had structures for prayer.
Based on culture and history, of the times, if you look at it, there's a clear reason why women are marginalized in the Bible. And then if they are there, it's in spite of the fact that culturally and in historical context would leave them out. So you need to understand that when they are there, they couldn't get away with not mentioning them, because you wouldn't be able to understand the story without them in it. But in general, they weren't meant to be there, because the way the Bible, if you unpack it, is talking about things is very tribal. So in other words, Abraham represents a man, but he represents much more than a man. He was a community of people who were connected to his family. It was him, his wife, his kids, his father, his all of his servants, and the people who thought, well, what he was saying was cool, and they all moved as an enclave. People didn't travel by themselves in the desert in the time. It was very unsafe to do that. So whenever you see individuals, they're actually representative of a group. So Abraham was a tribe, and his sons were each time a tribe, and all of Jacob's sons were tribes. And tribes were never named after a woman. They were named after men. It was a patriarchal society.
My generation, we lived in fear of the Cold War, of the nuclear bomb and all this. For a later generation, after 2001, yeah, September 11th, it was fear of terrorism. Today, yeah, it's climate change, yeah, which many of the 15, 16, 17-year-olds are extremely worried about. And yes, we try to listen to that in Teze and to try to understand what is God saying to us through these concerns.
I saw a real need for songs for primary school children which were accessible to them musically and lyrically, but they still had some theological depth to them. So when I was when I started teaching in the early 80s, a lot of the songs that in primary schools we sang were sort of, I call them the rainbow, daffodil and butterfly songs, and they were cute and they were fun and they were good for religious education, but we kind of tried to squeeze them in to make them gathering songs or communion songs, and they weren't, you know. So I thought, surely we can get music which is still attractive and accessible to children, but it actually matches what we're trying to do liturgically and theologically. So that's what started me off.
It's the Pietà by Michelangelo. What do we know about the creation of this masterpiece?
Indeed, thanks, Beate. It was originally commissioned by a French cardinal who was the papal ambassador, the French ambassador to Rome. And Rome at the time was the capital of the papal state. So it was commissioned by the cardinal for the French chapel in the old St. Peter's Basilica, the basilica built by Constantine in the 4th century for the cardinal's funeral piece. So it would have been an extraordinary work of art, unprecedented in its time in Rome, being a high Renaissance work of a Florentine sculptor in what was essentially an old medieval basilica. So the Pope at the time was Rodrigo Borgia, Pope Alexander VI. So the French cardinal was commissioning it to a Florentine sculptor again for a piece in Rome. So it was a very important work for Michelangelo because he was young at the time when he got the commission. He was only 23 in 1498. He was now coming to Rome, to a city that he would not have been well known in, to do a work of art for a French ambassador.
I consider a song is just like a monologue. It just obviously has the heightened nature of music underneath. But you still need all of the storytelling skills and great connection to the audience when you're singing, as if you're acting. So for me, whether it is on any type of production, I'm always really, you know, looking at the character and their journey. I would say I probably get my most satisfaction from the stage because I like being able to complete the full story in that one evening. Whereas when you're shooting a film or a television series, you're often doing things out of order. You know, you might be doing scenes from the last episode on your first day. So you really have to have a sense of where you've come from and where you're going to as a character. But I love the variety. I think in New Zealand you don't get pigeonholed, and that's really, really, really wonderful. So it means I've really had such a wide variety in my career. And long may that last. You know, older and bolder, trying things, that's mostly what I'm interested in, is new, exciting experiences.
Maybe you can just again clarify the difference between ecumenism and interfaith.
Sure, sure. Well, ecumenism, which derives from a Greek word oikoumene, meaning the whole inhabited earth, or the sense of being together, and was a movement that began or emerged out of the late 19th century, when initially Christian missionaries from different organizations and different churches began to ask the question, why are we competing with one another? In the missionary field, in terms of evangelical conversion, we're all trying to bring people to the same Lord, but we're doing it through different routes and it becomes confusing. Ecumenism came out of the context of trying to resolve issues, competitive praxis and so on, relating to a diversity of Christian denominational identities. So that's ecumenism, is actually, you might say, crossing borders and boundaries and evolving relationships within the diversity of one religious tradition. And although the term was coined within Christianity, you can, by analogy, apply it into other religious contexts as well. Whereas interreligious engagement, dialogue, or interfaith activities or whatever are across the main religious identities and main religions themselves, however they may be expressed.
Son of David, son of Abraham. Now, I couldn't think of a better way of going into the New Testament than the genealogy that tells us all about in Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament. So the whole thing is that the New Testament is hidden in the Old Testament. I mean, if we don't know the Old Testament, it's just a list of meaningless names, but they're there for a purpose, to establish the identity of Jesus. This, of course, is the most Jewish of the Gospel, and there are genealogies right through the Old Testament. Genesis 10 is a genealogy, the sort of the ancestry. We all carry the ancestry of others of the past, and that establishes our identity now. If we want to know who Jesus is, we go to his own scriptures. And there's such a, it's a list of names, sure, but it's got a purpose.
So, Brother Kieran, would you compare it to like a whakapapa?
Absolutely, because a whakapapa establishes the identity of someone today in terms of their past. And really, unless we appreciate the story of the Hebrew scriptures, then how can we appreciate the one who is the fulfillment of them?
And what is coming up at Titi Paunamo, Study and Joy? Our next Zoom events are Bible stories. What do they mean? Join us in unraveling Bible stories and looking for answers within a group. Our next session is Sunday, 7th of July, 5 to 6 p.m. on Zoom. And then on Sunday, 21st of July, again from 5 to 6 p.m., we will have Debbie Miller with us. She will introduce to us some powerful and amazing women in the Bible and in our lives. Please also check out our wide range of video clips on more topics around cultures, environment, religions, and beliefs. For further information and registration, please check out my website at www.studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha and keep safe. Out there, oh,